ends, much like our own, whereas the term metaphysical refers to no place, no time, no thing, no fact, not even wonders of such stuff as dreams are made of. Belief in a land of the souls of the deceased, for example, located in the West and reached by crossing a river, this is not in itself a metaphysical notion, though it may be given a metaphysical reading. Nor can we call metaphysical the idea of a multiplicity of worlds, one or more spanned over us, others stretching under us, the central one the home of man, the upper or lower the home of the gods and happy souls, the other the home of the unhappy. Such images are not the final terms of our subject, if it is of metaphysics that we are treating. They have often served, indeed, as vehicles of metaphysical expression, and part of our problem, certainly, is to collect, compare, and classify them. But we miss our proper point if we rest with them as they stand, for an image may signify various things in various contexts and to various minds. Furthermore, where an image has disappeared, it need not follow that the tenor of its reference has disappeared. This may be lurking under another image entirely. Nor in cross-cultural comparisons can we safely assume that because the symbolic figures differ from culture to culture, the tenors of their references must differ also. Let us consider, therefore, a brief series of mythological images culled from a number of cultures which may be discovered to be the vehicles of a single metaphysical tenor. Imagery of the Manifold and Its Cause. Natalie Curtis, in The Indians Book, published years ago, 1907, a remarkable origin myth recounted to her by an aged Pima chief, Hovering Hawk. In the beginning there was only darkness, everywhere darkness and water. And the darkness gathered thick in places, crowding together and then separating until at last out of one of the places where the darkness had crowded, there came forth a man. This man wandered through the darkness until he began to think. Then he knew himself, and that he was a man. He knew that he was there for some purpose. He put his hand over his heart and drew forth a large stick. He used the stick to help him through the darkness, and when he was weary, he rested upon it. Then he made for himself little ants. He brought them from his body and put them on the stick. Everything that he made he drew from his own body, even as he had drawn the stick from his heart. The stick was of greasewood, and of the gum of the wood the ants made a round ball upon the stick. Then the man took the ball from the stick and put it down in the darkness under his foot. And as he stood upon the ball, he rolled it under his foot and sang, "I make the world, and lo, the world is finished. Thus I make the world, and lo, the world is finished." So he sang, calling himself the maker of the world. He sang slowly, and all the while the ball grew larger as he rolled it, till at the end of his song, behold, it was the world. Then he sang more quickly, "Let it go, let it go, let it go, start it forth." So the world was made, and now the man brought forth from himself a rock and divided it into little pieces. Of these he made stars and put them in the sky to light the darkness. But the stars were not bright enough, so he made Taumik, the Milky Way. Yet Taumik was not bright enough. Then he made the moon. All these he made of rocks drawn forth from himself, but even the moon was not bright enough. So he began to wonder what next he could do. He could bring nothing from himself that could lighten the darkness. Then he thought, and from himself he made two large bowls, and he filled the one with water and covered it with the other. He sat and watched the bowls, and while he watched, he wished that what he wanted to make in very truth would come to be. And it was even as he wished, for the water in the bowl turned into the sun and shone out in rays through the cracks where the bowls joined. When the sun was made, the man lifted off the top bowl and took out the sun and threw it to the east. But the sun did not touch the ground, it stayed in the sky where he threw it, and never moved. Then, in the same way, he threw the sun to the north, and to the west, and to the south. But each time it only stayed in the sky, motionless, for it never touched the ground. Then he threw it once more to the east, and this time it touched the ground and bounced and started upward. Since then the sun has never ceased to move. It goes around the world in a day, but every morning it must bounce anew in the east. It is impossible to read this story without thinking of the far-flung old-world theme of the primordial giant out of whose body the universe proceeds, and who, until the end of time, remains within the forms of the universe as the self of all. In the beginning, this universe was only the self in a human form. We read in the Sanskrit Brihadaranyakupanishad. He looked around and saw nothing but himself. Then, at the beginning, he cried out, I am he. Whence came the name I? That is why even today, when a person is addressed, he first declares, it is I, and then announces the other name that he goes by. He was afraid. That is why people are afraid to be alone. He thought, but what am I afraid of? There is nothing but myself, whereupon his fear was gone. He was unhappy. That is why people are not happy when they are alone. He wanted a mate. He became as big as a woman and a man embracing. He divided this body, which was himself, into parts. From that there came husband and wife. Therefore this body, before one marries a wife, is like one of the halves of a split pea. He united with her, and from that were born men. She considered, how can he unite with me after producing me from himself? Well then, let me hide myself. She became a cow, but he became a bull and united with her. From that were born cattle. She became a mare, he a stallion, she a she-ass, he a he-ass, and united with her. From that were born the one-hoofed animals. She became a goat, he a buck, she a ewe, he a ram, and united with her. From that were born goats and sheep. Thus did he project everything that exists in pairs, down to the ants. Then he knew, indeed, I am myself the creation, for I have projected this entire world. Whence he was called creation. Sometimes, as here, the projection of the world is pictured in Brahminical mythology as voluntary. Sometimes, as the Kalika Purana, where the gods spring spontaneously from the yogic contemplation of the demiurge, Brahma, the creation is a succession of surprises, even to the creator. In the Icelandic Eddas, it will be recalled, the cosmic hermaphrodite Ymir gives off rime giants from his living hands and feet, but is attacked during a later age by the young gods, Votan, Vil, and Vi, to be cut up and transformed into the entire theater of the cosmos. Comparably, in the celebrated Babylonian epic of creation, the young god Marduk kills, cuts up, and fashions the universe from the body of the primal chaos monster Tiamat. Ovid, in the first chapter of his Metamorphoses, states that a god in the beginning brought order out of chaos, and we learn from the ancient Egyptian Memphite theogony that Egypt, the universe, and all the gods came forth from Ptah, the Great One, him with the lovely face. In the Indian metaphysical system of the Vedanta, which purports to be a translation of the metaphorical imagery of Brahminical myths into abstract philosophical terms, the primordial entity out of which the universe proceeds is described as a fusion of pure consciousness, Brahman, Vidya, and ignorance, Maya, Avidya, where ignorance, Maya, is compared to the female of the mythological pair, furnishing at once the womb and the substance of creation. By virtue of her obscuring power, she occludes the absolute Brahman, and by virtue of her projecting power, she refracts the radiance of that absolute in the forms of the world mirage, somewhat as a prism breaks the white light of the sun into the seven colors of the rainbow. For, as Goethe has phrased the same concept in his Faust, we have our life in the colorful reflection. In the 15th century Vedantasara, this marriage of ignorance and consciousness, illusion and truth, Maya and Brahman, is described as at once the efficient and the material cause of all things. Consciousness associated with ignorance, and the latter possessed of the two powers, is both the efficient cause and the material cause of the universe. Just as the spider, when considered from the standpoint of its own self, is the efficient cause of the web, and, when looked upon from the standpoint of its own body, is also the material cause of the web. Translated into Kantian terms, ignorance as here interpreted corresponds to the a priori forms of sensibility, time and space, which are the inmost and outmost boundaries and the preconditions of all empirical experience. These a priori forms occlude the metaphysical realm of absolute reality and project the universe of phenomenality. But what the true being of the ultimate reality, dissociated from our modes of experience, might be, we shall never know. For, as the great Chinaman of Königsberg phrases it, what might be said of the things in themselves, separated from all relationship to our senses, remains for us absolutely unknown. Thus, Hovering Hawk, the Brihadar Unyakupanishad, the Kalika Purana, the Eddas, the Babylonian Epic of Creation, Ovid, the Memphite Theogony, Vedantic Philosophy, Kant and Goethe through varieties of metaphor, have stated and stated again a single thought, and what would appear to be an easy thought to state, namely, the one, by some sleight of hand or trick of the eye, has become the manifold. Yet instead of stating this thought directly, they have employed allegorical vehicles, now of pictorial, now of abstract character, and curiously, though each of the vehicles succeeds in conveying at least a hint of the tenor of the message, none actually elucidates it. None really explains or even directly represents the mystery of the coming of the manifold out of the one. And in this respect, Kant's formulation is no more satisfactory than Hovering Hawk's. But the problem, again regarded, is seen to be not susceptible of outright elucidation, for it is a problem of the relationship of a known term, the universe, to an unknowable, its so-called source. That is to say, it is, strictly speaking, a metaphysical, not an empirical, problem. Whether such a problem be presented for contemplation in the picture language of the myth or in the abstract of philosophy, it can only be presented, never elucidated. And since it is thus finally ineffable, no single metaphor, no combination of metaphors, can exhaust its implications. The slightest change of standpoint and the entire conception undergoes kaleidoscopic transformation, as do likewise the correlative vehicles of imagery and communication. The primordial one, for instance, may be represented as masculine, as in the case of Brahma, feminine, as in the world mother, hermaphrodite, as in the case of I and Ymir, anthropomorphic, as in most of the above presented examples, theriomorphic, as in the Persian myth of the dismembered world ox, botanomorphic, as in the Eddic image of the world ash Yggdrasil, simply ovoid, as in the stories of the world egg, geometrical, as in the tantric yantras, vocal, as in the cases of the Vedic sacred syllable Om and the Kabbalistic tetragrammaton, or absolutely transcendent, as in the cases of the Buddhistic void and the Kantian Ding An Zih. But even the notion of the oneness of the primordial is finally only a metaphor, referring past itself to an inconceivable term beyond all such pairs of opposites as the one and the manifold, masculinity and femininity, existence and non-existence. The cause understood as absolutely unknown. Kant supplies an extraordinarily simple formula for the proper reading of a metaphysical symbol. What he offers is a four-term analogy. A is to B as C is to X, which points not to an incomplete resemblance of two things, but to a complete resemblance of two relationships between quite dissimilar things. Not A somewhat resembles B, but the relationship of A to B perfectly resembles that of C to X, where X represents a quantity that is not only unknown, but absolutely unknowable, which is to say, metaphysical. Kant demonstrates this formula in two examples. 1. As the promotion of the happiness of the children, A, is related to the parents' love, B, so is the welfare of the human race, C, to that unknown in God, X, which we call God's love. 2. The causality of the highest cause is precisely in respect to the world what human reason is in respect to the work of human art. He then discusses the implication of the second of these examples as follows. Herewith, the nature of the highest cause itself remains unknown to me. I only compare its known effect, namely the constitution of the universe, and the rationality of this effect with the known effects of human reason, and therefore I call that highest cause a reason, without thereby attributing to it as its proper quality either the thing that I understand by this term in the case of man, or any other thing with which I am familiar. Mythological, theological, metaphysical analogies, in other words, do not point indirectly to an only partially understood knowable term, but directly to a relationship between two terms, the one empirical, the other metaphysical. The latter being absolutely and forever and from every conceivable human standpoint, unknowable. If this be so, then we shall have misread the series presented in section 2 if we suppose that we have fully caught its tenor in the simple statement, the one, by some sleight of hand, has become the multiple. Such a statement furnishes indeed a terse summary of the vehicular aspect of the analogous metaphors, but leaves undeclared their metaphysical tenor. That is to say, it summarizes only the first two terms of an implied four-term analogy, which would read, fully rendered, as follows. As many, A, proceed from one, B, so does the universe, C, from God, X. But the term X, it must be insisted, remains absolutely unknown and unknowable. Oneness can no more be a quality of this X than can love or reason. Hence, as Kant has declared, it is only by analogy that we speak of love or reason, unity or even being as of God. X remaining unknown, then, the precise nature of its relationship to C must likewise remain unknown. Magic, simple fission, sexual procreation, violent dismemberment, refraction, effusion, and dilution are among the relationships suggested, not as proper to the mystery of creation itself, but as vehicles to carry the analogy. And there are no end of possible vehicular relationships, no end of possible A terms and related B terms. For instance, as Earthmaker, B1, is related to the things drawn from his body, A1, as All-Father, B2, is related to the creatures that he has begotten, A2. As Meditating Brahma, B3, is related to the visions of his meditation, A3. As Occluded Light, B4, to its refractions, A4. As the Spider, B5, to its web, A5. Etc., 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 ad infinitum, B to the nth, A to the nth. So is God, X, related to creation. C. Theology as a misreading of mythology. Unless the myths can be understood or felt to be true in some such way as this, they lose their force, their magic, their charm for the tender-minded, and become mere archaeological curiosities, fit only for some sort of reductive classification. And this indeed would appear to be the death that the heroes of the myths themselves most fear. Continually they are pointing past and through their phenomenal to their universal transcendental aspect. I and the Father are one, declares the Christ, for example, John chapter 10, verse 30, and Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita shows that all the forms of the world are rooted in his metaphysical essence, just as that essence itself reciprocally is rooted in all things. Neither the hosts of gods nor the great saints know my origin, for in every way I am the source of all the gods and great saints. He who knows me, birthless and beginningless, the great Lord of worlds, he among mortals is undiluted, he is freed from all sins. I am the self existing in the heart of all beings. I am the beginning, the middle, and also the end of all beings. Of the gods I am Vishnu, of luminaries the radiant sun, of bodies of water I am the ocean, of measures I am time, of beasts I am the Lord of beasts, of birds I am the Lord of birds, of fishes I am the shark, of streams I am the Ganges, I am the gambling of the fraudulent. I am the power of the powerful. I am victory. I am effort. I am the harmony of the harmonious. Of punishers, I am the scepter. Of those who seek to conquer, I am the statesmanship. Of things secret, I am silence, and the knowledge of the knowers am I. Comparably, killer of enemies, the hero of the Jicarilla Apache tribe of New Mexico, declares when he is about to depart from the people, "The earth is my body. The sky is my body. The seasons are my body. The water is my body too. The world is just as big as my body. The world is as large as my word, and the world is as large as my prayers. The seasons are only as great as my body, my words, and my prayer. It is the same with the waters. My body, my words, my prayers are greater than the waters. Whoever believes me, whoever listens to what I say, will have long life. One who doesn't listen, who thinks in some evil way, will have a short life. Don't think I am just in the east, south, west, or north. The earth is my body. I am there. I am all over. Don't think I stay only under the earth or up in the sky or only in the seasons or on the other side of the waters. These are all my body. It is the truth that the underworld, the sky, the waters are all my body. I am all over. I have already given you that with which you have to make an offering to me. You have two kinds of pipe, and you have the mountain tobacco." Or, once again, in the words of Aeschylus, "Zeus is air, Zeus is earth, Zeus is heaven, Zeus is all things, and whatsoever is higher than all things." "We should understand well," said an old Sioux medicine man, Black Elk, the keeper of the sacred pipe of his tribe, "that all things are the works of the Great Spirit. We should know that he is within all things. The trees, the grasses, the rivers, the mountains, and all the four-legged animals and the winged peoples, and even more important, we should understand that he is also above all these things and peoples. When we do understand all this deeply in our hearts, then we will fear and love and know the Great Spirit, and then we will be and act and live as he intends." Wherever myths still are living symbols, the mythologies are teeming dream worlds of such images, but wherever systematizing theologians have appeared and gained the day, the tough-minded in the gardens of the tender, the figures have become petrified into propositions. Mythology is misread then as direct history or science. Symbol becomes fact, metaphor, dogma, and the quarrels of the sects arise, each mistaking its own symbolic signs for the ultimate reality, the local vehicle for its timeless, ineffable tenor. "But he who is called Krishna," said the 19th century Indian teacher Ramakrishna, "is also called Shiva, and bears the names Shakti, Jesus, and Allah as well, the one Rama with a thousand names. The substance is one under different names, and everyone is seeking the same substance. Nothing but climate, temperament, and names vary." Esoteric and exoteric anthropology. And so now we have to ask whether mythology can have originated in the camps of the tough-minded and only later have become sublimated and sophisticated into metaphysical poetry by the broodings of the tender-minded, or whether its course of development must not have been in precisely the opposite direction, from the poetical imagery of the tender-minded to the clumsy misreadings of the ungifted many. Franz Boas appears to have been a champion of the former view. In his article already referred to, "The Ethnological Significance of Esoteric Doctrines," he wrote, "It may be said that the exoteric doctrine is the more general ethnic phenomenon, the investigation of which is a necessary foundation for the study of the problems of esoteric teaching. It is, therefore, evident that we must not, in our study of Indian life, seek for the highest form of thought only, which is held by the priest, the chief, the leader. Interesting and attractive as this field of research may be, it is supplementary only to the study of the thoughts, emotional life, and ethical standards of the common people, whose interests center in other fields of thought, and of whom the select class forms only a special type." Professor R. R. Merritt, on the other hand, in his article Mana in the Encyclopedia Britannica, 14th edition, appears to take the opposite view. By the very virtue of his profession, he writes, the medicine man or the divine king must hold himself apart from those who by status or by choice are Noah, laymen. The latter may live in brutish contentment, but to the end they lack enlightenment, participating in the highest mysteries at best from without. Every member of a primitive society is, in some degree, versed in experience of the occult, though for the most part, some better qualified person is present to help him through it. Whether primary or secondary in temporal terms, that is to say, in terms of which came first, the tender-minded esoteric view is clearly the one that has played the chief role in the significant shaping of traditions, since it is everywhere the priests and shamans who have maintained and developed the general inheritance of myths and symbols. Radin, I observe, like Boaz, regarded the role of the intellectual as secondary in primitive societies. He gave due recognition to the force of philosophical thought in the shaping of their cultural inheritance, however. And since we cannot go back even hypothetically to the moment when a metaphysical insight first dawned in a human mind to learn whether myths, rituals, and symbols had already given shape to the society in which the first genius lived who thought like a philosopher, perhaps Dr. Radin's balanced recognition of the dialogue of the two types in the continuance and development of primitive traditions is about as far as we can go. How are we ever to trace properly the development of thought and, more specifically, that of our fundamental philosophical notions, he asks, if we begin with false premises? If it can be shown that the thinkers among primitive peoples envisage life in philosophical terms, that human experience and the world around them have become subjects for reflection, that these ponderings and searchings have become embodied in literature and ritual, then obviously our customary treatment of cultural history, not to mention that of philosophical speculation, must be completely revised. For myself, I believe that we owe both the imagery and the poetical insights of myth to the genius of the tender-minded, to the tough-minded only their reduction to religion. As far as I know, in the myths themselves, the origins of their symbols and cults have always been attributed to individual visionaries, dreamers, shamans, spiritual heroes, prophets, and divine incarnations. Hovering Hawk, for example, when asked how his people made their songs, replied, "We dreamed them. When a man would go away by himself, off into solitude, then he would dream a song." In any case, the time has certainly come, as Paul Radin told us long ago, for the collectors and classifiers to regard the pretensions of their materials to a deep significance. From every corner of the globe they have gathered images, tales, and myths. Yet the science of interpreting the materials can hardly be said to have broached even the first outpost of the psychology of man's approach to and experience of the metaphysical. For up to now, the interest of the scholars has been almost exclusively ethnological and historical. They have analyzed from many points of view what may be termed the stylistic variations of the vehicles. Yet what such stylistic variations signify, it will certainly be impossible to say until the tenors of clusters of analogous metaphors have been established and understood. For the bedrock of the science of folklore and myth is not in the wisps and strays of metaphor, but in the ideas to which the metaphors refer. Mythogenesis. A revision of Joseph Campbell's paper read in Ascona, Switzerland at the annual Eranos meeting of 1959. An American Indian legend. If an authority on architecture looking at the buildings of New York were to observe that most of the older ones were of brick, then viewing the ruins of ancient Mesopotamia, remarked that the buildings were all of brick, and finally, visiting Ceylon, made the point that many of the early temples were of brick, should we say that this man had an eye for architecture? It is true that bricks appear in many parts of the world. True also that a study might be made of the differences between the bricks of Ceylon, those of ancient Sumer, those, say, of the Roman aqueduct still standing in southern France, and those of the city of New York. However, these observations about brick are not all that we should like to hear about the architecture of the cities of the world. Now let me suggest a problem in the architecture of myth. Early one morning, long ago, two Sioux Indians with their bows and arrows were out hunting on the North American plains, and as they were standing on a hill peering about for game, they saw in the distance something coming toward them in a strange and wonderful manner. When the mysterious thing drew near, they perceived that it was a very beautiful woman dressed in white buckskin, bearing a bundle on her back, and one of the men immediately became lustful. He told his friend of his desire, but the other rebuked him, warning that this surely was no ordinary woman. She had come close now, and setting her bundle down, called to the first to approach her. When he did so, he and she were covered suddenly by a cloud, and when this lifted, there was the woman alone, with the man nothing but bones at her feet, being eaten by terrible snakes. "Behold what you see," she said to the other. "Now go, tell your people to prepare a large ceremonial lodge for my coming. I wish to announce to them something of great importance." The young man returned quickly to his camp, and the chief, whose name was Standing Hollow Horn, had several teepees taken down, sewn together, and made into a ceremonial lodge. Such a lodge has 28 poles, of which the central pole, the main support, is compared to the Great Spirit, Wakantanka, the supporter of the universe. The others represent aspects of creation, for the lodge itself is a likeness of the universe. "If you add 4 sevens," said the old warrior priest Black Elk, from whom this legend is derived, "you get 28. The moon lives 28 days, and this is our month. Each of these days of the month represents something sacred to us. 2 of the days represent the Great Spirit. 2 are for Mother Earth. 4 are for the 4 winds. 1 is for the spotted eagle, 1 for the sun, and 1 for the moon. 1 is for the morning star, and 4 are for the 4 ages. 7 for the 7 great rites, 1 is for the buffalo, 1 for the fire, 1 for the water, 1 for the rock, and finally, 1 is for the 2-legged people. If you add all these days up, you will see that they come to 28. You should know also that the buffalo has 28 ribs, and that in our war bonnets we usually wear 28 feathers. You see, there is a significance for everything, and these are things that are good for men to know and to remember." This wonderful old Oglala Sioux priest explained to the young scholar, Joseph Epes Brown, who had come to the Pine Ridge Reservation, South Dakota, expressly to gain knowledge firsthand of the mystic dimension of American Indian mythology, the image of the man consumed by snakes. "Any man who is attached to the senses and things of this world," he said, "is one who lives in ignorance and is being consumed by the snakes that represent his own passions." One is reminded by this Indian image of the Greek legend of the young hunter Actaeon, who, in quest of game, following a forest stream to its source, discovered there the goddess Artemis bathing, perfectly naked, in a pool. And when she saw that he looked lustfully upon her, she transformed him into a stag that was then pursued by his own hounds, torn to pieces, and consumed. And not only are the two legends comparable, but the old Sioux priest's interpretation of his own accords with the sense of the Greek. Moreover, his interpretation of the symbolism of the ceremonial lodge suggests a number of themes familiar to us as well, so that we are moved to wonder what the explanation of these accords might be. When the people of Black Elk's legend had made their large ceremonial lodge that was symbolically a counterpart of the universe, they all gathered within it, extremely excited, wondering who the mysterious woman could be and what she wished to say to them. Suddenly she appeared in the door, which was facing east, and proceeded sunwise around the central pillar, south, west, north, and again east. "For is not the south the source of life?" the old teller of the tale explained. "And does not man advance from there toward the setting sun of his life? Does he not then arrive, if he lives, at the source of light and understanding, which is the East? And does he not return to where he began, to his second childhood, there to give back his life to all life, and his flesh to the earth whence it came?" "The more you think about this," he suggested, "the more meaning you will see in it." This sturdy old son of the American earth, now nearly blind, had been born in the early 1860s, fought as a young man at the Battle of the Little Bighorn and the Battle of Wounded Knee, had known great chiefs, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Red Cloud, and American Horse, and at the time of this retelling of his legend, the winter of 1947 to 1948, was keeper of the sacred pipe. He had received the treasured talisman, together with its legend, from the earlier keeper, Elkhead, who had prophesied at that time that as long as the pipe was used and its legend known, the Oglala Sioux would live. But as soon as the legend was forgotten, they would lose their center and perish. The pipe and its legend, then, were of indeterminate age, anonymous, practically timeless. Yet actually, more closely regarded, they could not have been much older than a couple of hundred years, for the Oglala Sioux did not migrate to the plains and become buffalo hunters there until the end of the 17th century, 1680 or so. They had formerly been a forest folk of the upper Mississippi, a region of lakes and marshes, where they traveled in birch bark canoes. And yet, as already remarked, although we may never have heard before of the sacred pipe of the Oglala Sioux or have numbered the buffalo's ribs, all the elements of this myth are curiously familiar. We recognize the bricks, so to say, though the way in which they have been put together is surprising. The ceremonial lodge is exactly comparable to a temple, oriented to the quarters with its central pole symbolic of the world axis. We have established here the center of the earth, the nearly blind old medicine man explained to his attentive listener, and this center, which in reality is everywhere, is the dwelling place of Wakantanka. But this figure of the center that is everywhere is a counterpart exactly of that of the hermetic 12th century Book of the 24 Philosophers, from which Nicholas Cusanus and a number of other distinguished European thinkers, Alan de Lille, Rabelais, Giordano Bruno, Pascal, and Voltaire, for example, derived their definition of God as an intelligible sphere whose center is everywhere and circumference nowhere. It is amazing indeed to catch the echo of such a metaphysical statement as this from the lips of an absolutely illiterate old Sioux living out his fading day as the guardian of an aboriginal Amerindian fetish and its myth. What are we to think of all these coincidences? Whence come these timeless, placeless themes? Shall we join our voice to those who write of a great perennial philosophy, which, from time out of mind, has been the one eternally true wisdom of the human race, revealed somehow from on high? How came this, then, with all its symbols to the Sioux? Or shall we seek our answer rather in some psychological theory, like many of the most distinguished 19th century ethnologists, Bastian, for instance, Taylor and Fraser, attributing such cross-cultural accords to the effect, as Fraser put it, of similar causes acting alike on the similar constitution of the human mind in different countries and under different skies? Do such images, that is to say, take form naturally in the psyche? Can they be assumed and even expected to appear spontaneously in dreams, in visions, in mythological figurations, any place on earth, wherever man has made his home? Or must it be said on the contrary, that since mythological orders, like architectural orders, serve specific historically conditioned cultural functions, where any two can be shown to be homologous, they must be assumed to be historically related? Can the Greeks and the Sioux, that is to say, be supposed to have received any part or parts of their mythological heritages from a common source? Or, finally, shall we simply set aside this whole question of shared motifs, whether religiously, psychologically, or historically explained, as unworthy of a scientist's speculation, since, as a number of important field anthropologists now hold, myths and rituals are functions of local social orders, hence meaningless out of context and, consequently, not to be abstracted and compared across cultural lines. Comparisons of that sort, enjoyed by dilettantes and amateurs, are, according to this view, neither significant nor of interest to a properly tutored scientific intelligence. Let us look further with an uncommitted eye and try to judge for ourselves. We note in Black Elk's commentary to his legend the formula 4 times 7, giving 28 supports of the universe. the numbers 4 and 7 being standard symbols of totality in the iconographies of both the Orient and the Occident. And this game of sacred numbers itself is a shared trait worth remarking. One of the 28 supports is in the center of the Great Teepee as the axis, the pivot of the universe. The number surrounding it then is 27, 3 times 9, 3 times 3 times 3. One thinks of the psychologist C.G. Jung's numerous discussions of the symbolism of the 4 and 3. One thinks of the 9 choirs of angels, 3 times 3, that surround and celebrate the central throne of the Trinity. 3 is the number of time, past, present, and future. 4 is the number of space, east, south, west, and north. Space, 4, and time, 3, constitute the field, the universe in which all phenomenal forms become manifest and disappear. Another way would be to think of the vertical, above, here, and below, plus the 4 directions, which again yields 3 plus 4. The number 4 recurs in the sacred turn, the clockwise circumambulation of the center, which is here associated not only with the 4 directions, but also with the life stages of the individual, so that the symbolism is applied as well to the microcosm as to the macrocosm. The 2 being tied by the related number 28 to the cycle of the moon, which dies and is resurrected, and is accordingly a sign of the cycle of renewal. Furthermore, as we are told, the buffalo has 28 ribs and is therefore himself a counterpart to the moon and the universe. Do not the buffaloes return every year, miraculously renewed like the moon? We think of the moon bull of the archaic Near East, the animal vehicle of Osiris, Tammuz, and in India, of Shiva. The horns of the moon suggest those of the moon god Sin, after whom Mount Sinai was named, so that it should represent the cosmic mountain at the center of the world, from the summit of which Moses descended. And his face then shone with horns of light, like the moon, so that when he stood before the people, he had to wear a veil. Exodus chapter 34, verses 29 to 35. Like the veils of archaic kings who, for centuries before his time, had been revered as incarnations of the self-renewing power of the moon. At the foot of Mount Sinai, the high priest Aaron was found conducting a festival of the moon bull in the image of a golden calf, which Moses angrily committed to the fire, ground to bits, mixed with water, and caused the people to drink in a kind of communion meal. Exodus chapter 32, verses 1 through 20. And, remarkably, it was only after this sacrifice that, returning to the mountaintop, where the earth, goddess, and heaven god are joined in eternal connubium, he received the full assignment of the law and promise of the promised land, not for himself, for he was now himself to become the sacrifice, but for the holy race. In the mythology of Christ crucified, 3 days in the tomb and resurrected, there is implicit the same symbolism of the moon that is 3 days dark. The sacrificial lamb, the sacrificial bull, and the cosmic buffalo. Their symbology was perfectly interpreted by the old Sioux medicine man, Black Elk, when he explained that the buffalo was symbolic of the universal in its temporal lunar aspect, dying yet ever renewed, but also in its 28th rib, of the Great Spirit, which is eternal, the center that is everywhere and around which all revolves. Chief Standing Hollowhorn, as Black Elk recounted in his tale, was seated at the west of the lodge, the seat of honor, when the beautiful woman entered. Because there he faced the door, the east whence comes the light, namely wisdom, which a leader must possess. And the woman, arriving before him, lifted the bundle from her back and held it out to him with both hands. "Behold this bundle," she said, "and always love it. It is Lelawakan, very sacred, and you must treat it as such. No impure man should ever be allowed to see it, for within this bundle there is a very holy pipe. With this pipe you will, during the years to come, send your voices to Wakantanka, your father and grandfather." She drew forth the pipe and with it a round stone which she placed on the ground. Holding the pipe with its stem to the heavens, she said, "With this sacred pipe you will walk upon the earth, for the earth is your grandmother and mother, and she is sacred. Every step that is taken upon her should be as a prayer. The bowl of this pipe is of red stone. It is the earth. Carved in the stone and facing the center is a buffalo calf who represents all the quadrupeds who live upon your mother. The stem of the pipe is of wood, and this represents all that grows upon the earth. And these 12 feathers that hang here, where the stem fits into the bowl, are feathers of the spotted eagle. They represent that eagle and all the winged things of the air. When you smoke this pipe, all these things join you. Everything in the universe, all send their voices to Wakantanka, the Great Spirit, your grandfather and father. When you pray with this pipe, you pray for and with all things. The proper use of the pipe, as expounded by its guardian priest, required that it should be ceremonially identified with both the universe and oneself. From the fire in the center of the lodge, the fire symbolic of Wakantanka, an attendant with a split stick lifted a coal, which he placed before the keeper of the pipe. The latter, holding in his left hand the pipe, took with his right a pinch of sacred herb, and elevating this to heaven four times, prayed, O Grandfather Wakantanka, I send you on this sacred day of yours this fragrance that will reach to the heavens above. Within this herb is the earth, this great island. Within it is my grandmother, my mother, and all four-legged, winged, and two-legged creatures who walk in a holy Wakan manner. The fragrance of this herb will cover the entire universe. O Wakantanka, be merciful to all. The bowl of the pipe was then held over the burning aromatic herb in such a way that the fragrant smoke, entering, passed through the stem and out the end toward heaven. Thus Wakantanka was the first to smoke, and the pipe, by that act, was purified. It was then filled with tobacco that had been offered in the six directions, to the west, north, east, and south, to heaven and to earth. In this manner, said the medicine man, the whole universe is placed in the pipe. And finally, the man who fills the pipe should identify it with himself. There is a prayer in which this identity is described. It runs as follows. These people had a pipe, which they made to be their body. O my friend, I have a pipe that I have made to be my body. If you also make it to be your body, you shall have a body free from all causes of death. Behold the joint of the neck, they said, that I have made to be the joint of my own neck. Behold the mouth of the pipe, that I have made to be my mouth. Behold the right side of the pipe, that I have made to be the right side of my body. Behold the spine of the pipe, that I have made to be my own spine. Behold the left side of the pipe, that I have made to be the left side of my body. Behold the hollow of the pipe, that I have made to be the hollow of my body. Use the pipe as an offering in your supplications, and your prayers shall be readily granted. This game, this holy game of purifying the pipe, expanding the pipe to include the universe, identifying oneself with the pipe, and igniting it in symbolic offering, is a ritual act of the kind represented also in Vedic Brahmanic ceremonials, where the altar and every implement of the sacrifice is identified allegorically with both the universe and the sacrificing individual. He who is in the fire, we read in the Maitri Upanishad, for example, he who is here in the heart and he who is yonder in the sun, he is one. Likewise, in the great Chandogya, now the light that shines higher than this heaven, on the backs of all, on the backs of everything, in the highest worlds, than which there are no higher, verily, that is the same as this light which is here within a person. One should reverence the mind as Brahman, thus with reverence to oneself, and now, with reference to the gods, one should reverence space as Brahman, that is the twofold instruction with reference to oneself and with reference to the gods. That Brahman has four quarters. One quarter is speech, one quarter is breath, one quarter is the eye, one quarter is the ear. Thus with reference to oneself. And now with reference to the gods, one quarter is fire, one quarter is wind, one quarter is the sun, one quarter is the quarters of the sky. That is the twofold instruction with reference to oneself and with reference to the gods. Now, as we have heard, the feathers of the sacred pipe are those of the spotted eagle, which is the highest flying bird in North America, and therefore equivalent to the sun. Its feathers are the solar rays, and their number is 12, the number exactly that we too associate with the cycle of the sun in the months of the solar year, and 12 signs, 3 times 4, of the zodiac. There is a verse in a sacred song of the Sioux. The spotted eagle is coming to carry me away. Do we not think here of the Greek myth of Ganymede, transported by Zeus, who came in the form of an eagle to carry him away? Birds, declares Dr. Jung in one of his dissertations on the process of individuation, are thoughts and flights of the mind. The eagle denotes the heights. It is a well-known alchemistic symbol. Even the lapis, the rebus, the philosopher's stone, made out of two parts and thus often hermaphroditic, as a coalescence of soul and luna, is frequently represented with wings, in this way standing for premonition, intuition. All these symbols in the last analysis depict that state of affairs that we call the self, in its role of transcending consciousness. Such a reading nicely accords with the part played by our North American spotted eagle in the rites of the Indian tribes. It explains also the wearing of eagle feathers. They are counterparts of the golden rays of a European crown. They are the rays of the spiritual sun which the warrior typifies in his life. Furthermore, as we have been told, their number in the war bonnet is 28, the number of the lunar cycle of temporal death and renewal, so that here Sol and Luna have again been joined. There can be no doubt whatsoever that this legend of the Sioux is fashioned of at least some of the same materials and thoughts as the great mythologies of the Old World, Europe, Africa, and Asia. The parallels, both in sense and in imagery, are too numerous and too subtle to be the consequence of mere accident, and we have not yet finished. For when the holy woman standing before Chief Standing Hollowhorn has taught him how to use the pipe, she touched its bowl to the round stone that she had placed upon the ground. "With this pipe you will be bound," she said, "to all your relatives, your grandfather and father, your grandmother and mother." The Great Spirit, the medicine man explained, is our grandfather and father, the earth our grandmother and mother. As father and mother, they are producers of all things. As grandfather and grandmother, however, beyond our understanding. These suggest the two modes of considering God that Rudolf Otto, in The Idea of the Holy, has termed the ineffable and the rational. The same as Joseph Epes Brown points out in his commentary on Black Elk's Rite, that are referred to in India as Nirguna and Saguna Brahman, the absolute without qualities, and the absolute with qualities, respectively. That beyond names, forms, and relationships, and that personified as God. This round rock, the very beautiful woman continued, which is made of the same red stone as the bowl of the pipe, your father Wakantanka has also given to you. It is the earth, your grandmother and mother, and it is where you will live and increase. This earth which he has given to you is red, and the two-legged people who live upon the earth are red, and the Great Spirit has also given to you a red day and a red road. The red road, Joseph Brown explains, is that which runs north and south and is the good or straight way, for to the Sioux the north is purity and the south is the source of life. On the other hand, there is the blue or black road of the Sioux, which runs east and west, and which is the path of error and destruction. He who travels on this path, Black Elk has said, is one who is distracted, who is ruled by his senses, and who lives for himself rather than for his people. The latter was the road followed by the man at the opening of the story, who was eaten by snakes. And so we notice now that even the ethical polarity that we recognize between the bird and the serpent as allegoric of the winged flight of the spirit and the earthbound commitment of the passions has been suggested here as well. These 7 circles that you see upon the red stone, the woman said, represent the 7 rites in which the pipe will be used. Be good to these gifts and to your people, for they are Wakan, holy. With this pipe, the two-legged people will increase, and there will come to them all that is good. She described the rites and then turned to leave. I am leaving now, but I shall look back upon your people in every age, for remember, she said, in me there are 4 ages, and at the end I shall return. Passing around the lodge in the sunwise way, she left, but after walking a short distance, she looked back toward the people and sat down. When she got up again, they were amazed to see that she had turned into a young red and brown buffalo calf. The calf walked a little distance, lay down and rolled, looked back at the people, and when she got up, was a white buffalo. This buffalo walked a little distance, rolled upon the ground, and when it rose, was black. The black buffalo walked away, and when it was far from the people, it turned, bowed to each of the four directions, and disappeared over a hill. The Wakan woman had thus been the feminine aspect of the cosmic buffalo itself. She herself was the earthly red buffalo calf represented on the pipe bowl, but also its mother, the white buffalo, and its grandmother, the black. She had gone to be restored to her eternal portion, having rendered to man those sacred thoughts and visible things by which he was to be joined to his own eternity, which is here and now, within him and all things in this living world. Let us try, therefore, to follow her to her source. The Neolithic Background. Let us peer first down the well of the past, the very deep well of history and prehistory, for actually a good deal is known concerning the history of our North American tribes and their mythologies. We know, for example, as already remarked, that the Oglala Sioux had not always been hunters of the buffalo, dwelling on the Great Plains. In the 16th and early 17th centuries, they had lived among the lakes and marshes of the upper Mississippi, in the woods of Minnesota and Wisconsin, traveling mainly in bark canoes. They had been a people of the forest, not the plains, and knew practically nothing of the buffalo. The white buffalo woman cannot possibly have been a factor in their mythology at that time. However, many of the older elements of this myth might have been known to them from of old, the symbolism, for instance, of the sacred sunwise turn, the cosmic ceremonial lodge, and the cycle of four ages. The ritual of the sacred pipe itself would seem to point, furthermore, not to an origin among hunters, but to a planting culture background, and indeed the Sioux, before moving to their 16th century station at the source of the Father of Waters, where they paddled delicate birch bark canoes on woodland rivers and lakes, had dwelt in that more southerly part of the long Mississippi Valley, between the mouths of the Ohio and Missouri, which scholarship now identifies with the maize-growing Middle Mississippi culture complex, many elements of which are known to have come from Middle American sources. For from as early as about 500 BC, influences had been entering and descending the Great Mississippi Waterway from Mexico, where, as the Spaniards found when they arrived in the 16th century, about the time the Siouan tribes were moving from the Middle Mississippi northward, there was flourishing a mighty civilization with many religious practices strangely similar to their own, based on agriculture, governing its festival year by an astronomically correct calendar, and supporting cities comparable in size, grandeur, and sophistication to the greatest in the Old World. The use of tobacco in the holy pipe, which is not a wild but a cultivated plant, should have let us know that its ritual could not have been originally of hunters. Besides, the Sioux and their neighbors on the plains were not simply hunters. They planted maize, squash, and lima beans, and these, like tobacco, had come to them from the south. In all, some 60-odd varieties of domesticated plants are known to have been cultivated in pre-Columbian Middle and South America, including maize, squash, the lima bean, pineapple, peanut, and avocado, kidney bean, pumpkin, white and sweet potato, watermelon, and tomato. Chocolate, rubber, and quinine, too, were first produced from these soils. Likewise, tobacco. An impressive amount of productive research has lately been conducted in those parts of Mexico and South America where the basic food plants of the New World are now believed to have been translated from their wild to domesticated states. The prehistoric period reviewed extends from circa 7,000 to circa 1,500 BC, with the millennium from circa 4,000 to 3,000 emerging as the critical one within which the first trustworthy signs of plant domestication can now be said to have been fairly certainly detected. The best rewarded excavations were those in the valley of Tehuacan and southwest Tamaulipas, Mexico, where a series of strictly controlled studies of the deeply stratified layers of debris in the floors of a number of once-inhabited caves yielded results that may be summarized as follows. A. In the layers of the Tehuacan Valley Caves. 1. In the deepest, so-called El Riego phase, circa 7200 to 5200 BC, signs are recognized of a number of wild plants later domesticated, a wild squash, chili peppers, avocado, and a wild cotton. 2. During the following Cuscatlan phase, circa 5200 to 3400 BC, indications become evident of several more food plants, gourds, amaranths, tepary beads, white and yellow zapotes, another squash, and primitive maize, a few of which plants may have been domesticated, though certainly not the maize, which here appears for the first time in the archaeological